Dr. Anne Jones here. I've been out and about recording nature sounds, but nature doesn't always oblige. For example, this wombat, yes, you, thought that my recorder was the perfect place to scratch its butt. So to find out what else that wombat got up to one night near Canberra, subscribe to Nature Sounds by Anne Jones on ABC Listen, on podcast apps, and also on the Wombat Butt Scratching Thumbs Up list.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Gadigal Land is the southern side of Sydney Harbour, all the way from South Head, upriver to Lane Cove, just so that you've got a picture in your mind. Last week, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and Pakistan set up a sort of NATO for the Middle East, each promising to defend the other from attack. It's a hugely significant development. Iran and Israel are on notice. The United States is sidelined. The impact to be discussed. And the history of punctuation. From the first little triangle pressed into clay in Mesopotamia 3,000 years or so ago to a smiley face emoji of today, an affectionate biography of the marks and squiggles that make sense of writing. But first to Anna Henderson to make sense of Canberra, chief political correspondent with SBS. Anna, welcome to the show.
Well, that's a very tall order, David. I don't know if I can make sense of the place this week, but I'll give it my best shot.
Don't talk yourself down, woman. Now look.
Oh, I'm not. I just mean some of it is so opaque.
We'll get there. Now, first the melon scandal. All over the News Limited newspapers. We didn't notice, but 6 weeks ago, when he was also saying he wanted to get into bed with Kylie Minogue, the Prime Minister discussed a gift of melons from the Prime Minister of Japan and held his hands in a suggestive manner. Now, we didn't notice this until today. How come? Has it broken over the Prime Minister's head, his hands?
Well, I think it's all in the interpretation, and I think there are a number of elements here. Can I take you back to, in fact, when you and I spoke about the visit on the night after the Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, came to Canberra. It was a very brief trip.
Yes.
And we discussed whether or not anything had really happened. And I know that many in the world of Japan-Australia relations were quite shocked that the media kind of summed up that not much happened, because they felt like it was a really substantial trip and engagement and had settled some really important things between the two countries. And then I remember asking, as we always do, so what was the gift exchange? And there was sort of a hush that went over the Japanese side, and they very quietly informed me that these very special crown melons, which are, you know, some of the sort of best fruit Japan has to offer, were going to be given to the Prime Minister. And it's quite unusual to have sort of edible, sort of fresh produce in the mix. But I thought that was interesting and something a bit different, and, you know, spoke to Japan's sort of trade, and these were very expensive pieces of fruit. So they're very excited about it. I'm sure that those on the Japanese side, when they're preparing their diplomatic cables, who listened to that podcast, would have been pretty shocked to hear the melons come up in this conversation and then be the subject
public
of
exposure
this
of melons.
And just it was absolutely meant to be a gift of high quality, like a really good bottle of wine.
Yep.
And now it's ended up in this discussion. But look, the Prime Minister's office is adamant that he was not making a suggestive gesture with his hands around the melons to suggest anything about the Japanese Prime Minister physically, that he was talking about the melons, that the person he was being interviewed by was adding in, you know, potentially suggestive innuendo, talking about Pamela Anderson, etc. But the Prime Minister was not making that inference in what he was doing and saying. But that hasn't stopped, as you say, not only the former Japanese ambassador here, Shingo Yamagami, from weighing in and being very critical. Some Japanese media representatives have also written about this and raised the question of whether or not it demeaned the Japanese prime minister.
And Anna, it was apparently so obvious that it took us 6 weeks to notice. I sit in a high-tech studio where there's a bank of televisions beaming newses from several channels to me as I speak to you, and I see, soundlessly, there he is again, moving his hands. I don't think they're cupped in a breast-like fashion at all. But anyway, News Limited does, and so we're in the midst of a scandal.
So we have had various political comments come through, particularly from the opposition, saying, does an apology need to be given, etc. What I can tell you from the Japanese side is that there has been no, that I'm aware, diplomatic concern raised here. Now, these are two countries that want to be side by side at the moment. In no way does the first Japanese prime minister, who's had previous issues around, you know, criticism of her gender, want to get wrapped up in another issue where she's not considered a strong Thatcherite leader that she wants to present herself as. So the message from Japan is, in terms of their diplomatic engagement with Australia, that this is not a big deal. It's not something they want to make an issue of, and they want to move on with the relationship, with the defence and strategic relationship between the two countries. But at the same time, you can't avoid the fact that a former ambassador has written a very critical piece, and that there are other Japanese media representatives who have questioned, you know, this being seen through a gender lens. The problem is that Shingo Yamagami was no fan of the Labor government. And so, you know, it always prompts this question of what sort of driven him to want to be so critical and to draw these inferences and assertions around the podcast. In the end, I think it was a pretty probably rough and misconstrued day at the office for the Prime Minister the day he recorded that podcast.
How could News Limited have missed it for how could News Limited have missed it for 6 weeks? 6 weeks until it was pointed out to them. Anyway,
I do need to say one thing around this. At the time, it did raise eyebrows. People were a little confused
the
by
the Mellon reference.
What was going on there? But if nobody raised it at the time, and the Japanese side didn't say that this is offensive, nobody was really raising it in a public, critical way of the Prime Minister, because it isn't really clear what's going on. But yes, as you say, it's now been raised in a different way, and it's been
Anna, those melons have been weaponized. Let me leave it at that. Weaponized. Now, look. There is one issue which the Prime Minister is in deep trouble about, and that is the response of his government to gambling. And it appears that he is reaching over the aisle, as they say in the United States, to talk to Angus Taylor about possible solutions.
It does. Well, they've definitely met today, and I think there are talks afoot. There's a deal afoot, David. I feel like when you're watching the trajectory of these things, you'll often see a few stories that say, you know, Labor says it's, you know, with us or not at all and we'll withdraw the legislation. I don't think that was ever really going to be the reality here, because the government is under a lot of pressure to do something on gambling ads. And so now, you know, the chats are happening with Angus Taylor. There's more focus on the inducement side of things, which wasn't necessarily going to be addressed in the same way. That hearing in the last week, I think, has really put a rocket under this issue, because it just exposed allegations that were so dramatic around drug use, about, you know, sex workers and other allegations of how gambling companies were potentially encouraging people to maintain their high roller status and the kinds of things that problem gamblers are being offered to keep on going. And I do think that has supercharged the conversation. But I also think, as I've said before, that, you know, any family sitting down to watch, you know, a rugby league game which spans past the 8:30 mark and ends up having their kids really exposed to a lot of gambling advertising, starts to wonder, you know, what the impact of that is on young kids, let alone problem gamblers who are, you know, dealing with this kind of material. So yes, it seems like the two are in discussions, and it will be a rare moment perhaps of them getting something done together in recent history. But at the same time, I think this is where both parties see themselves as being able to potentially point to how a strategic mainstream, in their view, party of government or opposition can work together. And that helps them provide even more distance with, you know, what populism and one nation and a party that can't actually get
but
things
Anna,
done.
But Anna, work together to do what? I hardly expect that Angus Taylor and the coalition are going to put together a pact with Albanese to, say, ban all gambling advertising, which is the fundamental wish of an overwhelming majority of Australians.
Well, no, that's not how the parliament will work this out. There'll be some kind of strategic move to reduce, and I think, as I said, the inducement side of things will be more of a focus. It won't be what some on Labor's backbench want. It won't be what the Greens want. The Liberal Party is under pressure because, you know, there's two pathways essentially. Labor can find a pathway with the Greens or a pathway with the coalition to get things through the Senate. And the Greens and what they're pushing for is outside the bounds of what the government wants to do at the prime ministerial level and cabinet level. So they want to find common ground with the coalition, which is under pressure to do the deal, so the sort of Greens approach doesn't end up being the way, you know, any government goes, which I don't think it would anyway. But we don't know everything that was discussed in that room today when the Prime Minister and opposition leader met to find out exactly what will be in this legislation. Sadly, I wasn't invited. But at the same time, you know, I do assume, given the pressure that's on Angus Taylor as well from within his party, that we will at least see some strengthening of what Labor initially put forward, even though it won't be, you know, what the Peter Murphy review recommended.
Now, immigration, there was a kerfuffle last week because Cabinet was expected to come up with a decision on fresh decision on immigration restriction. It didn't happen. Where are we with that now?
Well, unless I should refresh my page and check, but unless we've had an update very recently, there's no rescheduled address for Tony Burke to head to the press club, which is where he was going to make this immigration announcement. And while, you know, I'm told from multiple people who were very aware of the cabinet deliberations that it wasn't a situation where Tony Burke went in, put his foot down and was rolled by cabinet. Apparently it was more like he had a number of options he presented, cabinet members were considering them. There was a little bit of concern about, you know, whether or not enough work had been done to settle on a final position. And so then cabinet wasn't prepared to, you know, choose one of the options essentially. So it was a misstep by the looks of things for Tony Burke to have already set himself, you know, a day at the press club, sell tickets and have this all laid out and ready to go if he hadn't done enough work to get cabinet on side. Now, you know how governments love to find the silver lining? I think there's now a view
they're very good
that,
at it.
That this time in between has actually meant that a lot of the problems in the immigration system, individual issues, have been sort of ventilated and focused on. Maybe we'll lay the groundwork for the public to be more educated about this issue when he actually gets to the press club. But I think it's all looked very messy, and that when he does get up, there will be some tough calls from the government around how they're going to ensure that the net overseas migration number is restricted. And some of the people who are very, you know, intelligent in this space, academics who've done a lot of work, just tear their hair out to think that the Labor government, which knows that net overseas migration is a measure that includes Australians returning to their country, is this sort of blunt instrument, has been weaponized by the right to say we've got mass migration and the borders are overflowing, when it may not be the best measure. But now the government has had to be held to that forecast. It's not even a target. It's just the forecast that Treasury puts out as whether or not they have met their immigration requirements as a government, and is now going to tighten all these settings to try and influence something which in the past they've said is not really able to be exactly influenced by government policy.
Do we, in brief, know what the minister wanted and the cabinet stopped him announcing?
Not really, because there were three options, and I don't know which one Tony Burke was pursuing, but it's there's multiple layers to it, and some of the discussion was going to be around like working visas, you know, even working holiday makers.
It's down in the details.
Family reunion. Well, one of the jitters is when you start talking about tightening up family reunion. And that's a big one because people who are trying to get visas to come and reunite with their families, when they can't get a family reunion visa because the backlog is massive and some people are waiting a decade or more, they might come on a student visa instead and get to Australia and then apply for asylum and they're already in Australia and so they're in that system and they can remain in Australia. So there's a whole lot of aspects where the government has and previous governments haven't wanted to upset yep. the sense in migrant communities that you should be able to reunite with your family. They're now going to tighten up quite significantly.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us once again on Late Night Live to explain the mysteries of Canberra.
Well, there's many mysteries we haven't got to. Hopefully next week.
They keep coming, don't they?
Thank you.
Coming up, the Mecca Defence Pact. In Mecca last week, Saudi Arabia, Turkey and Pakistan signed a defence agreement. Its terms remain secret, but all three countries have said in the last few days that the new pact will operate much as NATO does, treating an attack on any one of them as an attack on them all. To discuss the new pact, we've asked Simon Mabon back on the show. Professor Mabon of Lancaster University is a specialist in Saudi-Iranian relations, which is why we were talking to him in March, in the early days of the US attack on Iran. Now, Simon, as the ground shifts in the Middle East, welcome back to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure.
How much of this pact do we really know about? The details are secret, but its intentions seem to be clear. But what is known, what's not known?
Well, I think there's a very easy answer to that. There's not much that is known other than this idea that an attack on one is an attack on all. But I think that what we're going to see over the coming days, weeks, months, perhaps even years, if it lasts that long, is that the proof is really going to be in the pudding. It's going to be in the eating of it. We're going to see what this really means if and when an attack takes place on one or more of the states involved in this pact, to see what the response is. Now, last week we saw Yemen's Houthi launching attacks on Saudi Arabia after the Mecca agreement was signed. And as yet, we have not seen a collective response. So that, I think, raises a number of quite important strategic questions about what this actually entails. But again, we don't know the details. We don't know the substance of the agreement. We've just had the press release. We've seen the photographs. And we're left sort of scratching our heads, I guess.
As I understand it, this agreement builds on an agreement between Saudi Arabia and Pakistan that was signed last year.
Yes.
Now, after that agreement was signed, Saudi Arabia was attacked by Iran. What was Pakistan's response?
Very little, to be honest. And that's why I sort of think that we need to wait and watch and see what is actually going to be happening with this updated agreement. We know that there was an agreement between the Saudis and the Pakistanis that would be a joint defense agreement of the sort that we're led to believe that this new updated Mecca agreement is going to be. And yet, there was no response. There was no military response from Pakistan. We know that there are military personnel and military equipment stationed, Pakistani military personnel and equipment stationed in the kingdom, of course. But as far as we're aware, it has not been used to strike Iran. And Pakistan itself has not been directly involved in striking Iran. And I think that highlights a lot of the complexities of some of these defense agreements, in the sense that the Pakistanis themselves have got a long and complex relationship with Iran. They share a border. They have challenging smuggling routes that cut across the border, across the Balochistan province. So there's a real set of complexities here that mean that it's not quite as easy to say that if one state in this pact is attacked, then the other will jump straight in.
Pakistan has the bomb. So this theoretically gives Saudi Arabia a nuclear shield.
Theoretically, yes. And I think a lot of people had been pontificating that if Saudi Arabia really did want to get a nuclear weapon over the past decade or so, that the way that it would get it would be via Pakistan due to its strong links. And that defense agreement suggested that that was the trajectory, the direction of travel. And yet, of course, we've now seen the strengthening of this defense agreement with Turkey. But we've also seen the civilian nuclear agreement between the Saudis and the Americans, assuming that that, of course, actually comes to fruition. And so there's a lot of different moving parts here, but I think that there is a real strategic dynamic to the Pakistan-Saudi component of this deal and the earlier deal as well, in that it does, in theory, as you say, provide a nuclear shield for Saudi Arabia.
It's also unclear, isn't it, what countries are actually involved here, because there is talk, isn't there, that the Gulf Cooperation Council states would also be somehow or other covered by this agreement.
Well, again, we hear rumours, but we just don't know what the substantive component of this is. But I think that what we can see is that if we look at the press release, we look at the photos that were leaked, the photo ops that were shown as part of this press release, we saw three figures. We saw three senior figures from the leading states in this pact. And that, I think, tells us that not all of the GCC states would be involved, if indeed any of them are. I can't fathom that the United Arab Emirates would be covered in this and not then want to be involved in a high-level diplomatic initiative such as the sort that we're seeing here. And that perhaps tells us that there are other dynamics, other currents at play. Perhaps we're hearing reports of other types of regional alignments. We know that the Israelis and the Emiratis have been working very, very closely, very strategically over the past few years since the Abraham Accords was signed, of course. We know that that involves India. And all of a sudden, if you start to look at this, you can start to see competing visions of order, competing regional alliances that suggest that there are maybe different machinations afoot, different currents playing out across the Gulf and across the wider Middle East and into Asia.
That photograph you were talking about was sort of those, you know, the official photograph. There is Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. There is the President of Turkey, Erdogan, and there is Shehbaz Sharif, Prime Minister of Pakistan. But they are also talking, are they not, about getting Egypt on board?
Yeah. They are. And Egypt has been one of the states that has been, I guess, quite heavily involved in a lot of the diplomatic initiatives and the sort of the regional posturing that the Saudis, that the Turks and the Pakistanis have been involved in. And so, again, I think that Egypt makes a lot of sense. Egypt has close ties politically and geopolitically to the Saudis, quite close with Turkey, but there are very serious points of difference, not least with regard to the Muslim Brotherhood, who were essentially exiled from Egypt 13 years ago, many of whom then found refuge in Turkey, given permission to reside there, essentially, by Mr. Erdogan. So there are points of tension. And again, there are points of tension across the other parts of this dynamic as well, which I think is really interesting.
One of the lines I've seen analysing the impact of this new pact is that it's going to bring Saudi money to Turkish innovation and Turkish technology. Do you see that as being one of the links?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are a number of different components to this. And I think that broadening out, diversifying the types of relationships between the different parties involved in this agreement is really central. The Saudis have got the geography, they've got the political standing, they've got the capital fundamentally. Turkey has got innovation, it's got excellent military bases, high-level equipment. And so that's an obvious link to try and develop. And of course, Pakistan has got a long-standing, high-level institutional credibility around its army. So you put all of that together and you get quite an interesting, quite an innovative, quite a flexible alliance that brings together capital, capacity, and institutional infrastructure.
And the country that has been most savaged by one of its neighbours, of course, is Pakistan. So what happens now if India loses its block again and marches an army into Pakistan or to some, you know, remote region of Pakistan? Does that mean that Saudi Arabia is going to join the fight?
Well, I guess that's the billion-dollar question. To what extent is this a substantive agreement that covers all three equally, or is it more about a strategic agreement that focuses on the Gulf region by virtue of logistical flows, capital, religious significance, etc.? And I think that is a very real and very substantive question, given the fractious dynamics between India and Pakistan, given the question marks over Kashmir and the skirmishes that we've seen. Are we going to see Turkish troops, Turkish technology then being used in Pakistan against India? That would be quite a significant shift, I think, in the global nature of politics and rivalries and alliances. And that would potentially have very, very serious repercussions, not just for India-Pakistan, but also for the wider Middle East and for global politics, raising questions about the role of China, raising questions about the role of the United States, and more fundamentally, I guess, the role of the United Nations. Although that, I guess, over the past few years has shown itself to be largely impotent over conflict resolution.
David Marr with you on Late Night Live, talking to Simon Mabon, Professor of International Politics at Lancaster University, about the Mecca Pact. Simon, let's go through the countries that seem to need to most consider their position as a result of this pact. Let's start with Israel. What is the effect on Israel going to be of this pact?
Well, I guess Israel is in a particular position in that it has long relied on the United States for its security, for its diplomatic cover. Now, over the past few months, we're seeing tensions between Israel and the United States. We've seen in recent days, Benjamin Netanyahu pushing back and rejecting the border peace / Donald Trump's vision for Gaza. And so I think that this is potentially quite a significant move for Israel, this establishment of this alignment of Saudi, Turkey, and Pakistan, in the sense that it brings together three powerful Muslim states who've had long and complex relations with Israel. Israelis were, I think, very, very keen to get Saudi normalization over the line. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been adamant that that will not happen without the establishment of a Palestinian state. And I think that Israel has had a complex relationship with Turkey, not least in Syria, but also more recently, we've seen strong condemnation from Israeli and Turkish leaders of each other and the actions of each other. So I think that there'll be some in Israel who are actually quite concerned that at a time when their relations with the US are perhaps a little bit shaky, that there is this alignment of powerful states in the Middle East and drawing Pakistan in that are potentially posing a significant challenge to the Abraham Accords and to Israel's vision of regional order.
There is some suggestion that this pact is foreshadowing a withdrawal of the United States from the region. Is that a possible interpretation, a preparation for a time when the United States withdraws its bases from the region?
Yeah, I think that's probably quite a substantive part of this, in the sense that, well, Donald Trump had been proclaiming a desire to withdraw from the region. Joe Biden had been setting out his aspirations. Barack Obama, the same. There's been a long-held aspiration of US leaders to pivot away from the Middle East, if not fully withdraw, then to pivot away. And I think that increasingly Gulf states, the Middle Eastern states, Saudi, Turkey, Pakistan, are realizing that the age of being beholden to the United States and relying on the United States to meet their security needs is perhaps over. We've seen over the past few months that Saudi Arabia has been reliant on the United States to enact its geopolitical whims and to try and deliver on its defense needs, but that has been conditional on the domestic views of people across the United States, which obviously diverge from the views of the Saudi elite. And so I think that the Saudis are trying to say, all right, well, we can't just rely on this one-size-fits-all approach. We need to diversify. There will be a day when the US withdraws, and we need to prepare for that. But in the meantime, we need to diversify our security needs away from Washington and find other ways of doing it that are perhaps more region-centered.
And what does it mean for Iran that this pact between Sunni Muslim nations against Shia Iran, what do you think is their response to it going to be?
Well, on the day that it was announced, the Iranians said that, oh, look, this means nothing. This is not anything that will provide lasting security for Saudi Arabia. That this is purely like a paper agreement, essentially. But then over time, over the past few days, we've seen more statements coming out of Iran that say, well, it doesn't really affect us all that much, in the sense that we're not having a conflict with Pakistan. We have good ties with Pakistan. We have complex but rather positive ties with Turkey. And we've shown that we can work with Saudi Arabia, that this is not an agreement that is fundamentally directed at us. And I think that there's a grain of truth in that, although this obviously comes at a time when there are deep-seated geopolitical rivalries that pit Saudi Arabia against the Iranians. But I think fundamentally, this is not just about Iran. It's about preparing the kingdom, Turkey, Pakistan, for what may come next, and for trying to cultivate a new form of deterrence, sure, against Iran, but also against Israel and against other forms of rivals that may emerge in the coming years.
But meanwhile, Simon, the Saudis are making agreements in order to try to keep the waterways open.
Yeah, that's really important in the sense that they need to keep the flow of oil going. They need to keep the flow of goods traversing around the globe. They've seen that that the choke point in the Strait of Hormuz can have a dramatic impact on the economy, on the Saudi economy, on the capacity to enact Vision 2030. They've seen that the Houthis' intention of closing the Bab al-Mandeb will have a dramatic impact as well. So they're trying to find ways of keeping these waterways open so that they can get their oil out, but so that they can also serve and fulfill the lifeblood of the global economy with regard to oil, but also goods and anything that is flowing. So I think it's really important that the Saudis are doing this. They're acting in a pragmatic way diplomatically, but also trying to cover themselves in case that diplomatic pragmatism is not working. And the Houthis, the Hashd al-Shaabi from Iraq, Hezbollah perhaps from Lebanon, although they are embroiled in their own conflicts with Israel, or the Iranians directly decide that attacking Saudi and crossing the Saudi state's red lines, notably an attack on Aramco, is the best option for them strategically. So I think they're trying to do the pragmatic thing diplomatically, but also provide that security and that level of security in case the pragmatic diplomacy does not work.
Saudi Arabia sends its oil out through the Strait of Hormuz, but it also has a pipeline, doesn't it, across to the Red Sea?
And, it does, yes.
And it is that the Houthis are interfering with, isn't it?
Yeah, they are. So the vast majority of the Saudi oil goes out through the Strait of Hormuz, but they are able to get some out through the Bab al-Mandeb, which the Houthis have sought to disrupt. And if we look at global shipping traffic, we've seen that traffic out of the Bab al-Mandeb on the east of Saudi Arabia, on the west of Saudi Arabia, and the Strait of Hormuz on the east are both down dramatically. So even though there is a pipeline that has sought to circumvent the Strait that the Saudis have cultivated, that too is contingent on getting oil out through the Red Sea, down through the Bab al-Mandeb, or conversely through the Suez Canal. But that obviously adds huge amounts of time onto the passage of ships who are predominantly taking oil out to Asia. So having to then go through the Mediterranean and then down across the southern tip of Africa and then back up and round, that's going to add a huge amount of time on.
Okay, so what's going to happen between the United States and Iran? What's your prediction for the next few weeks? Is the United States just completely defeated here?
Well, that's what some Democrats are saying, that the US has lost this war. And I think it's easy to come to that conclusion. I don't think that it has necessarily lost. I don't think that that the war is over per se. I think that there are a range of strategic challenges facing both states, both at home and across the Gulf. We've seen Donald Trump saying today that they're sort of taking a watching brief, waiting to see what might happen, how economic pressure in Iran is building. And I think a cynical reading of that is to say the US is trying to rebuild its arsenal, trying to replenish the stockpile of missiles and anti-aircraft and anti-missile technologies that have been diminished by the war. But a more generous reading is that, well, the pressure is mounting on Iran. The blockade of Iranian ports is hurting the Iranian economy. But I guess the worry is that there are more attacks from the Houthis on Saudi, crossing Saudi red lines, hitting Aramco, more attacks from the Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. Or I guess the real worry is that we start to see the proliferation of these different actors hitting targets across the region that try and reignite a hot war. Because right now we're in a bit of a frozen conflict.
Simon, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live. I know we're going to be back for more. I have been talking to Simon Mabon, Professor of International Politics at Lancaster University and one of the world's experts on Saudi-Iran relationships. Simon, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, the sweet history of dots, dashes and exclamation marks. Punctuation, taken for granted by some, fought over by others, a matter of snobbish concern, a matter of good taste and elegance, a matter with a very long history. Punctuation, says my next guest, has been the neglected stepchild of writing, designated as the invisible ushers of the sentence, simply telling words where to sit. Florence Hazrat is a German-Iranian writer, researcher, and one of the world's foremost authorities on the history and culture of punctuation. She's just written a wonderful book, A History of Punctuation from Ancient Egypt to the Emoticon. It's an affectionate biography of what she calls the forgotten signs that have crept into the spaces between our words over many, many centuries. So now, it's time to unpack the fascinating backstory of the dots and the dashes and the squiggles and the slashes, without which our sentences would simply fall apart. Florence joins us now from Berlin. Florence, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me and thank you for being curious about those dots and dashes.
Curious? These have been subjects of concern, debate, since I was about 12. Now, Florence, from your book, it struck me that the really radical act that took an extraordinarily long time was to put spaces between words.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we are so used to our text looking the way it does now that it's sometimes quite difficult for us to take a step back and realize that all of this had to be developed at some point by our ancestors, right? And in the past, for example, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, they didn't use spaces between words because for them, in a way, writing was just another manifestation of speech. It was just a record of speech. It didn't have its own parameters and its own behaviors and needed its own treatments. So it kind of makes sense that they wouldn't necessarily think of marking somehow that there's a beginning and there's an end. And actually, when we speak, we don't necessarily also hear that, right? But in kind of phonographic records of speech, we do make these like tiny, tiny, tiny pauses. So yes, at the beginning, there were no spaces between words. It was just like one long line. And then at some point in the kind of early Middle Ages, in the 8th century, some monks in this far-flung place called Ireland were trying to understand the Latin Bible together with the Gaelic translation, and they found it really difficult to be able to do that when they didn't actually know where a word in Latin began and ended. And so they introduced these tiny, tiny spaces. And that was really such an incredible change and invention, because then writing becomes much more accessible and much faster.
Monks in Ireland who didn't know Latin very well. We need to be grateful to them. But you've already sort of indicated that punctuation has a purpose, and text, until really late on, was not going to be published. It was going to be used to speak from. These were the texts of speeches, and therefore the punctuation they needed was quite different from the punctuation of texts for reading.
Yes, exactly. So in antiquity, the ideal man, the ideal public kind of politician or lawyer, for example, was able to hold a speech that was persuasive, intelligent, nice to listen to, and powerful. So also, you know, creating emotions in the listeners. So the spoken word was the ideal. And hence, all of these writers would either have their personal way of marking a pause here, or use your hand, use your finger, for example, to create a gesture that supports what you're saying. And we kind of still have that. For example, there are texts by Thomas Jefferson in his handwriting where he also does that. So that's really still with us. But these ancient Romans would have such a command over Latin that they, in a way, didn't need punctuation. And actually, they even looked down on it because they felt, well, your Latin ought to be so good and your writing in Latin ought to be so good and so rhythmical that you kind of don't need to have any mark that tells you where to pause, because you should really know yourself. And if you don't, then you should go like become more educated and then become a orator.
Now, this is a matter of bitter personal importance for me. The dash. Do you see the dash as essentially for speakers rather than readers?
Ooh, I understand where you're coming from because it tells the speaker to pause and potentially quite abruptly. I personally also love reading the dash or seeing it on the page because it is so disruptive, and it might give us clues as to the mental state of the speaker, right? Maybe they are in an uproar and their thinking becomes fragmented, for example. So I think the dash especially can do a lot visually when we read it on the page, and at the same time it also has this oral quality.
I was sat down by a former prime minister of this country. I'd written a book about him being deposed in a coup. And he quite liked the book, but he took me to task for the dashes. He said, they are for speakers, not writers. And something like 40 years later, I'm still smarting from that, Florence. Still smarting.
He should read my book if he's still alive.
No, alas.
Send it to him and convince him.
No, alas. Now, Florence, let's go right back to the beginning. Somewhere thousands of years ago, somebody made a mark in a slab of clay to indicate a gap between words. Now, who, when, why?
Well, in 5,000 years ago in ancient Mesopotamia, someone really made this leap of thought, which I think is really the most impactful invention of humanity, which is to invent writing, right? So our speech, broken into syllables, for example, and later into alphabetical letters, and then inventing signs that are completely abstract, right? So punctuation was right there at the beginning as well, depending on what our definition of punctuation is. If it's just really this sort of narrow repertoire of dots, question marks, brackets, okay, that comes later. But if we think of punctuation as any sign that is not a letter that gives us information about the text, for example, that tells us about the relationships between individual phrases, again, beginnings or endings, or how to read something out, like an exclamation mark, for example, the tone, the grammar, then things become much more expensive because we have, for example, capital letters as giving us information. Maybe that's a title, or we are supposed to stress this word, or somebody is shouting, right? And back in the days, 5,000 years ago, the very first punctuation, I think one could say, is just a line, a horizontal line between a paragraph. So people have always been thinking in units, right? So I think the paragraph is the very first punctuation concept in a way. And then the line between these paragraphs can be seen as the very first mark.
And the Egyptian hieroglyphs had paragraphs.
Yes, they had paragraphs as well. That was horizontal. You know, they were horizontal, and they also had signs, specific signs for pauses, for example. And that became very important when you have, for example, a magical formula that needs to be pronounced in exactly the right way so as not to like conjure anything else but what you want to conjure. So there we see how punctuation really becomes quite crucial for the meaning and the purpose. And there's also rubrication and hieroglyphs. That means where they picked out one word in a different color, for example, the name of a priest or the name of a pharaoh. And that, again, is part of punctuation because it creates difference in text and it gives us more information than simply the meaning.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I am talking to Florence Hazrat about the history of punctuation. Florence, libraries played a role too, didn't they? And in particular, the Library of Alexandria.
Yes, libraries were absolutely crucial for the development of writing and also punctuation. And Alexandria, 2,000 years ago, was just an incredibly bustling place. Lots of trade, different kinds of people together, coming together, different languages. And the rulers at the time, that was, you know, Greek-influenced Egypt, they wanted to create this place of learning as well and attract scholars. And scholars were treated quite well in Alexandria at the time, you know, that has me a bit jealous as a former scholar at university. And
we've lost so much since Alexandria, Florence, so much.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. And the head librarians were very powerful figures because they would decide how text had to look like. And then that kind of looks of text, this design, would be influential because there were 500,000 books or scrolls in Alexandria, and scholars would come and like work with them, right? And these head librarians were constantly trying to find ways of making text more stable, more accessible. And one of these, the third head librarian, called Aristophanes of Byzantium, he felt that some of his readers who were not native Greek speakers struggled with this continuous script, right? They kind of didn't have a grasp over the basic units of the language. And so he introduced a system of dots at the bottom, in the middle of the line, and at the top of the line for different parts of the sentence. Now, it's a little bit difficult to explain because we don't sadly have this deep grammatical knowledge of sentences and anymore, but a period. So like one whole sentence that's done grammatically and rhythmically would get a certain kind of dot and then the smaller parts, so a colon and a comma, which sort of works like our comma and colon today.
But it's interesting, isn't it? It's the library in Alexandria, the monks in Ireland. They are working out punctuation to help people who are unfamiliar with the language.
Yes, precisely. So we see this throughout the history of punctuation that it always had this democratic push. So making writing more accessible, the same goes for Arabic, for example. Just some 150 years ago, Arabic only had kind of, again, units of thought that were very, very broad and paragraph-like, and then they would maybe put a flower or something. And then people realized that very, very few people were actually writing in Latin and had this in Arabic and had this grasp of Arabic. So they also imported European punctuation to make sure that people who hadn't had this incredible education on the ins and outs and the depths of Arabic would be able to read it. So we see that throughout the history of punctuation. And then also the reverse of that is people who actually don't want others to have access, right?
Yes.
Women or less educated people, or people who weren't in the church, for example, or going back to Cicero, who said, no, I don't want this riffraff who doesn't have education in Latin, or even his scribe, to be able to interpret text and access knowledge.
And This messy development, I love your use of the word messy, this messy development of punctuation comes to a point when the printing press is invented. And then there has to be a common system. And do you reflect that the development of punctuation is really remarkable for the extent of its of the understanding of it, that people knew what a question mark, a parenthesis, a full stop meant once the printing world began?
Yes. So once printing began, it was maybe it had the sort of impact as the internet and the phone and the computer today, because it just changed everything, that suddenly you can reproduce quite a lot of copies that are nearly identical with not a lot of manpower. You don't have to have 20 scribes scratching on parchment all day. Of course, also we have the introduction of paper and creating cheaper paper. And so all of these things come together. And then text spreads throughout Europe and beyond. So
you've got this, you have this extraordinary statistic in the text. 15 to 20 million items are estimated to have gone to press within 50 years of Gutenberg's invention. 15 to 20 million.
Yes, that's shocking if one considers that in the early 15th century, it was considered an incredible wealth if you owned 20 books. So, yeah, exactly. And we also have, of course, the development of schools by the early humanists, you know, who thought we need people to work in the Commonwealth, we need civil servants, they need to be educated. And so they would found schools and stuff. So there's also a rise in literacy. All of this is like the perfect storm kind of for this boom in text. And so punctuation also spreads all across Europe and starts to stabilize, also because these boys, sometimes also girls, would work from the same grammar. So, for example, Erasmus, the famous scholar, would create these grammars that were being used all across different countries of Europe. And at the same time, though, it does take a little bit of time for people to quite understand how things work. So in Shakespeare's Folio, in these complete works that came out in 1623, there is still a little bit of a doubt over a question mark and an exclamation mark, for example, which makes sense. Nowadays, when we have rhetorical questions, we use both, right? Because both have something to do with tone, emotion, being shocked. Sometimes we are shocked and we have questions, or we are just shocked and outraged, exclamation mark, right? And also today, I think some older people maybe aren't quite sure how to use emojis right? Or hashtags or something.
Florence, it's so unfortunate that we haven't got time to go into emojis, because I want to spend the moments we've got left. What do you hate? What punctuation mark do you hate? And do you think punctuation is a really peculiar focus of snobbery?
Oh, I don't hate any mark. That's a very, very difficult question. Maybe apostrophes, because I somehow feel that they create so much kind of stress for pupils at school. And George Bernard Shaw, for example, hated them. He said they look like ugly bacilli on the page, that he just didn't like them at all, and he wrote without them. And you know, it's understandable. People, you know, you can still understand the text, it just takes a bit longer. So I hope that with a book I can make people change their minds about punctuation, actually, that it's not snobbery. And also because I don't really push grammatical rules on them at all. I'm much more interested in how people use punctuation in a creative way, or the social history of punctuation, where a famous Irish diplomat was hanged based on a comma that the judge didn't accept, or something like that, right? And punctuation affects all our lives. We are with it every day. We're using it every day. And I'd like to invite people to become more sensitive to what a dot 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 actually does to them, right?
The ellipse.
The ellipse.
Yes.
Exactly.
I love the ellipse. It saves me from having to think what I need to write. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you for having me, David. It was a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Florence Hazrat, author of On the Mark, A History of Punctuation from Ancient Egypt to the Emoticon. And that's the show. On our next, as he always does, Bruce Shapiro will make sense of the great puzzles of the United States. We look at the prospects for elections in Palestine, and we celebrate an 18th century orphan composer, Agatha, whose work has been discovered and performed in Venice by the Australian Chamber Choir. Until then.